You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of July 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Bastille Day. We're honored to be here in your beautiful country, and it certainly is a beautiful country.
Donald Trump visits Paris. Why is Emmanuel Macron so keen to be his best European friend? My guests Gaia Lutz, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daniel Giacopelli will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the imprisonment of Brazil's former president, the latest revelations to emerge from Donald Trump Jr.'s diary, and what now for Parisian shoppers who also want to choose between 73 sorts of mineral water as Colette announces its closure. That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Gaia Lutz, Daniel Giacopelli, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome, everyone. And we will start tonight in Brazil, at which a few nervous glances may currently be being cast from Washington. Yesterday, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was convicted of corruption charges and sentenced to 9 years in prison. This follows, of course, last year's impeachment and removal from office of his successor, Dilma Rousseff, on corruption charges, and more or less coincides with what may prove a temporary reprieve from corruption charges for her successor and president incumbent, Michel Temer. I hope everybody's keeping up. We have two actual Brazilians in the studio here this evening, one of which, Fernando, I will ask first. Let's start off trying to be optimistic. I mean, obviously, Brazil's political class is, I think rotten is a word we can use. But is there an argument that the system is actually kind of functioning, that the institutions are working? Because these people are not, well, they're getting away with it up to a point, whatever it is they've been getting away with, but people in high offices are being prosecuted and imprisoned.
Yeah, I think the positive take that some institutions in Brazil are indeed working. I think our judiciary is being extremely good, and I think some countries wouldn't do what Brazil is doing. And we're going to the big people, we're going to governors, we're going to former presidents. But again, at the same time that some of our institutions are working, the quality of our politicians is incredibly bad. I mean, when I look at the Brazilian Congress. I'm not saying that everyone is involved in corruption cases.
It's but quicker to name the ones who aren't.
Yeah, I feel despair. Honestly, I feel despair, and in some ways, it makes me sad. But on a positive note, the institutions are working. Our media is free to report anything. You know, there are some positive things to talk about as well.
Gaia, is there, how to put it, is there still kind of a sense of anger and outrage among Brazilians? Because this has been going on literally for years. Has it got to the point at which it's just become, I don't know, a bit like the weather in Britain? People just sort of roll their eyes and say, what are you going to do?
Definitely. I mean, I think anger and outrage was about 2 years ago, and then it turned into despair and hopelessness, and now it's almost, you know, it's, we have an expression in Brazil which is to laugh, not to cry. It's almost like that, you know, another scandal comes out, you laugh at it because it's so absurd. You know, what happened with Michel Temer, which you were talking about earlier, he basically manipulated a vote in a committee so that he's not charged with corruption. He did that by substituting 13 members of that committee weeks before the vote, that we're going to vote against him. I mean, that is just so blatant, and everyone knows, but it's despair. You know, we see that happening, but it happens so often. And as Fiss said, the judiciary is working, but when you have that balance with such a bad Congress, it's very hard to sort of for the judiciary to work in the way it should, in a way, because you can manipulate votes in this way, and you can manipulate other parts of the procedure of democracy.
Danny, it has been a peculiar spectacle watching an entire political class rot, and it has been going on for ages. And obviously, you are this studio's token North American, once again, representing your entire people, all 330 million of you.
Weekly.
Weekly. We should stress that's W-E-E-K-L-Y, very much not the other kind. Are there any lessons here, for example, a country not so very far from yours? Could what has happened in Brazil conceivably be beginning to happen in the United States?
I mean, I recall this really great essay that I read in New York Magazine back in January. And it was written by the guy who basically edited GQ in Moscow. And he had this story where he was traveling with his Russian buddy and they were in traffic and all of a sudden an ambulance flipped on its lights, but nobody would budge because everybody assumed that it was carrying VIPs to go to the airport. And so his whole thing was that, you know, once you even kind of get the idea in your head that that could be possible, the rest is all over because you have the idea that it's corrupt. Why would I do anything? Just assume that the guy in there is corrupt. And then everything else rots. So has America reached that point? I mean, you know, if you have a president who lies in every other sentence, what's real, what's false? I mean, it starts to erode reality and you can't trust anything anymore. I don't think we've reached that yet, but we're rapidly approaching where you can't trust what the White House says about things. I mean, there's always some kind of spin on it. And not like old school spin where it was like a little bit of an angle. It's like they could be blatantly lying through their teeth. I don't think we're there yet, but we could get there.
Fernando, is there that sense of, you know, kind of despair, hopelessness to the point of finding it kind of funny that Gaia mentioned? Obviously, it's not an ideal situation in the long term. Is there in Brazil right now any sense of somebody that's going, or somebody or some force that is going to change things, whether it will be the pragmatic bureaucrat who just sort of carefully fixes everything, or the populist demagogue who just, you know, throws over the table?
No, and I think it's quite sad because even as a kind of a center-left person myself, the left kind of speech at the moment is just kind of to defend Lula. You know, I don't want to judge him, you know, because, you know, his whole process didn't end.
The judge has already done that.
Well, but he's going to the Supreme Court now. But I think the left needs to come with another speech. Perhaps don't connect themselves with Lula so much. Perhaps we need, you know, saying yes, we need a strong state. We need to improve the social security of the lives of Brazilians, but not only with the image of Lula. But again, I was reading a column on Folha de São Paulo, a guy called Clovis Rossi. He's 74. And after the dictatorship said, I don't know how to cover elections without Lula. Because since Brazil became a democracy, he was there on the ballot paper. So perhaps next year is going to be the first one without him, which is a major change.
Gaia, but before we move on this subject, move on from this subject, we'll try and close on an optimistic note. The downside is that the Brazilian scandal has now reached as far as Peru, where former President Ollanta Humala and his wife turned themselves into the cops today. But again, is it possible really anymore to get away with it forever? Is it now the case that we can find out too much too fast for you to be able to pull, you know, a major fiddle in high office for a protracted period?
I would say no, but look, this is really unprecedented in Brazil's case. This is a country where we say everything ends in pizza. You know, nothing ever falls through. Yes. This is an actual expression. We use it in every sort of newspaper cover when things don't get followed through. We say another political scandal ends in pizza. And for the first time, you know, we're seeing, you know, incredibly wealthy businessmen behind bars. You know, Emilio Odebrecht, the man from the company that was taking all these illegal rights, he's in prison for over a year now. And that's so unprecedented in Brazil. Now, if things will remain like this, if he'll get out next year, if all of this will be put under wraps, I'm not sure. But I'm optimistic that for the first time, people feel they can't get away with it.
Okay, well, on that note, let's turn to Washington, where in an unsurprising development, it has emerged that the account given by Donald Trump Jr. of his already celebrated 2016 meeting with a Russian lawyer may have been incomplete. Also present, it emerges, was one Rinat Akhmetshin, a Russian-American dual citizen whom, prior to working as a Washington, D.C. lobbyist, also put in a stretch as an officer in a Red Army counterintelligence unit, among other escapades. Danny,
where do we begin?
I stopped asking that question about 2 years ago. Even if this meeting was no big deal,
was Putin and Assange on the video call?
You do start to wonder. But even if the meeting was no big deal, as Akhmetshin now claims, and as Trump Jr. has previously claimed, is Trump Jr.'s failure to disclose Akhmetshin's presence now a big deal?
Of course. Not only him, though. Jared Kushner. Because remember, Trump Jr. is not a member of the Trump administration.
True.
But Kushner is. Kushner is a senior advisor with security clearance.
With security clearance.
So what he's done already is, some would argue, and some have argued today, far worse than what Flynn has done. You know, Flynn, of course, was booted out for being a foreign agent. If Kushner, the senior advisor to the president, was in this meeting and didn't disclose it a number of times, you know, how many things can he not remember now? He keeps saying, I don't remember. you know, it stretches credulity.
Fernando, is it possible? I mean, during a presidential campaign, you have a lot of meetings. Is it possible that the details of one just slipped his mind?
No. First of all, I mean, he must have some sort of schedule. Huh? So, you know, even if he doesn't remember immediately, I'm sure if he looks back at his files...
You would have thought
files,
in the last few days he'd have gone back and had a look, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I'm sure he will keep some sort of record of all his meetings. Otherwise, I mean... You have to, basically.
I mean, you could tell, though, from Trump Jr.'s email, like, it was a bit of an informal thing. He was on the road, you know, sent from his iPhone or whatever. He said, yeah, sure, set it up. If it's what you say it is, I'll love it. I mean, it wasn't that formal, but still, you would think he would remember. Whether or not he knew this guy was a former counterintelligence officer is another thing, but, I mean, whether there was two more people in the meeting, perhaps a translator as well.
I mean, don't you look people... I mean, I look people up before I meet with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people... I mean, and the nature of the meetings I generally have really couldn't matter less in the grand scheme of things. And yet, I would... if someone said, I want to bring this guy to the meeting, I would look him up.
And it's weird how he got there. It seems he was just a friend of that female Russian lawyer who came. And because I think
who doesn't take their friends to meetings with sons of presidential...
I think it's the Daily Beast. Somebody had like records of that day, what they did, where they went the next day. I mean, they were traveling together, those two. And they ended up in Washington, D.C. for this meeting where it seemed like she was sitting behind the former U.S. ambassador to Russia.
So we will come back.
The tracks are known.
We will come back to that shortly because there is people attempting to flam a conspiracy theory out of that coincidence. But Gaia, how at this point, now that we know about this other person and an interpreter who were also present at the meeting, and we don't know yet quite what else Donald Trump Jr. is going to recall in coming days. I'm already getting sort of visions in my head of just like, you know, hundreds of people crowded into his room. How hard are we having to work right now to come up with a completely innocent explanation for all of this?
I mean, very hard. I think as Danny said, even just the language of Trump Jr., even though it was very informal, if he says, you know, if this is what it is, love it. I mean, that sort of indicates that he's open to people from Russia coming with sort of Clinton information. Even the openness suggests that there's something fishy there, right? Even if the meeting was had nothing in there, I just think that email is already pretty incriminating for just the language of it.
But Danny, on the subject of working hard, then there are
you turn to me
naturally, but there are pro Trump media outlets, pro Trump spinners, trying to get up the story that this whole thing was some sort of plant or sting operation by the Democratic Party.
Yeah, you have guys like InfoWars and stuff.
How does this actually work in theory? They set up a meeting with dubious Russian contacts in order to discredit Donald Trump Jr. and by association his father, and then release it a year afterwards when it's too late.
Yeah, there's no logic to it whatsoever.
Is that
and also
the plan?
The details themselves.
Am I missing something?
No, but people are saying, oh, she posted on Facebook photos of herself at anti-Putin rallies, but actually. Yeah, she posted photos of anti-Putin rallies, but the text of it, which was in Russian, which they didn't care to translate, was critical of the protesters. So all of this is just complete rubbish. But, you know, if you do look at some of these comments, it's unbelievable. There's one person in the U.S., and I forgot who it was a media commentator, who said, oh, maybe the Russian lawyer was planting listening devices on Team Trump.
Brilliant.
For the purposes of benefiting Team Clinton and Team Obama, and you know, it's such a farce.
It'd be quite funny if that turned out to be true, though.
It would. We'd all have egg in our face.
Fernando, if you were at this point the White House's director of communications, and you know, funnier things have happened. look who's the president, for example. How do you kill this story? How can Donald Trump make this go away?
Well, I think he can easily go away because I mean he can just write another tweet, you know? It's as simple as that.
Well, I mean, the one story, though, that, you know, came out today that we haven't talked about is also there's more evidence that this was a sustained campaign on Russia's part because the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Europe, Eurasia, and Emerging Threats has come out and said he was actually approached in Moscow with the same sort of information around the time of that meeting. So it was a campaign on the part of the Russians, it seems. And he's a friend of Russia, this guy. He's a pro-Putin guy. And he said, yeah, they approached me.
Okay, well, we will have, I'm sure, ample opportunity to further discuss Donald Trump Jr.'s social life in coming days and weeks. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Gaia Lutz, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daniel Giacopelli. Coming up next, Emmanuel Macron lays on a special musical treat for Donald Trump.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around.
Now, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Gaia Lutz, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daniel Giacopelli. Here is some music. One of the hits of Daft Punk there, as played by a French military band for a select audience, including President Emmanuel Macron of France, who clearly enjoyed the performance, and President Donald Trump of the US, who sort of squinted at it as if searching for a way that he could somehow infer that it was all about him and therefore begin enjoying it. President Trump was last seen engaging President Macron in a handshake, which may still be going on now. That was part of the Bastille Day celebrations in Paris today, at which Donald Trump was the guest of honour. Happy Bastille Day to all our French listeners. First of all, the music itself, Fernando, what kind of fist do we think the French military band made of Daft Punk there?
I loved it. In fact, it gave me goosebumps. And I think I was not the only one, because looking at President Macron's face during the performance, he was so joyous. I mean, I could see his eyes were shining, and it was quite a great performance.
I do recommend to listeners looking up the visuals, not just for the very differing reactions of the two principal guests, but the kind of the choreography of the marching band is something to enjoy. Gaia, as Fernando mentioned, Macron seemed to be clearly quite enjoying himself. Do we get the impression he was enjoying the performance in and of itself, or was he also allowing himself to have a small joke at the expense of his guest?
Maybe both. I'm not entirely sure. What I found was much more funny was the differing expressions of Donald Trump and Macron. Trump looked like he had no idea what was being played, even though this is probably a hit in the U.S. as well. Get Lucky. I mean, this is Pharrell singing, and he just looked at it like, wow, this is some great marching band music. But he didn't look like he knew what he was doing. They were doing, but. I think Macron could have been having a little dig at him, but I think Bastille Day is really, you know, it's the most important holiday in France. I think he was enjoying the day most of all.
Now, I am going to leap to the defense of your president here, Daniel, which is not something I do terribly often.
Let me guess, you hate Daft Punk.
No, I don't hate Daft Punk at all. I'm just saying that really there's no particularly good reason why a 71-year-old man, he is 71, isn't he?
Yeah.
Thereabouts. Should know a Daft Punk tune when he hears one. He did look somewhat baffled by
my parents probably don't know Daft Punk. I mean, you know, it's not like something if they played the Beatles maybe or something like that. It's something that everybody in the world would know.
I don't think you'd know any song that was played.
Yeah.
Pop.
Yeah, I mean, what does Donald Trump listen to?
It is. I've always
what's
thought,
on his iPod?
I have always thought
Kid
this
Rock.
About him. It is desperately difficult to imagine him enjoying a piece of music or reading a book or a work, enjoying a work of art for its own sake.
You mean just being a person?
Yeah, just sort of appreciating a thing.
It is very funny, though. You should go on YouTube and check it out. It's a funny video.
Danny, what do we make of the fact that Emmanuel Macron seems so very determined to be Donald Trump's friend?
I don't know if he's trying to be his friend. I mean, if you watched the press conference yesterday, it was pretty painful. I actually like Macron more and more the more I kind of see his interactions with Trump, because he really seems like a man who knows exactly what he's doing with kind of like the whole game of it all, with the handshakes, with the little facial tics, with what he says. I mean, he says, "You're my friend," but then he also says, you know, you know, he says we differ completely on the Paris Accord. Yesterday he said that, but yet we dine together at the Eiffel Tower. I don't know if he's necessarily trying, but he has to try at least. He's the president of France. I mean, it's a great kind of transatlantic relationship.
I do also recommend to listeners looking up the video of the interminable Trump-Macron handshake. It has been timed at approximately 25 seconds. I assure you, it seems an awful lot longer than that. On that subject, Fernando, is Macron just being realistic when he thinks, look, whoever the president of the United States is, they are the president of the United States, I am the president of France, I have to get on with them?
Yes, and I think he did the right thing. He's the president of France. You know, and as Dennis said, you know, it's an incredible transatlantic relationship with France. And I don't think this will hurt Macron that much. And I was read a French commentator mentioned that, you know, France has gone through a bruising electoral campaign. So to be honest, I don't think the French care that much at the moment about Trump's visit. You know, after they have their own election, their own problems with Marine Le Pen and everything. So to be honest, I think the French are just like, cool, he's just being diplomatic. You know, it's going to be good for France.
Because, Gaia, there are going to be European and other leaders, aren't there, especially if they are facing an election. Macron, as we have pointed out, has just won one. But you think if you're facing an election, it's going to be a bit tight and you're basically the leader of any other country in the world but the United States and possibly Russia. Having a bash at Trump is an easy win, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I also think, you know, we all know that flattery works with Donald Trump. So, I mean, you know, you bring him in, you show him a big display of your country's arms and weapons and whatever. He likes that. He enjoys that. He responds well to that. And I think that's also a good strategy. And I mean, it works with him. You do that, I think Trump is sort of on your side. He's very easily manipulated. I mean, from what it seems, I think. And also, I think there's a sense as well that, you know, not taking it to the Trump, too far into the Trump thing, but, you know, I think there's a sense of Macron just wanting to show the grandeur of France. I mean, as Fernando said, France has been through a very hard election campaign, and it also has been through a very hard couple of years. And I think now Macron wants to like sort of reignite this old image of grandeur. He did the same with Vladimir Putin 6 weeks ago. He took him around Versailles with this golf cart, you know. So I think there's a sense of, you know, it's not really about Trump. It's just him trying to say to France, look, we're awake, we're here, we're back to being an important superpower. So I think there's a bit of that too.
We have Daft Punk. That's what he was saying as well. Not all countries have them. You know.
Well, let's stay in Paris. It is maddeningly unclear whether the Trumps found time to do any shopping at the famous boutique Colette. But if they didn't, they may have missed their last chance. The store on Rue Saint-Honoré is to close in December in acknowledgement of the futility of continuing without its founder and overlord, Colette Rousseau. The statement announcing the closure said, and I really wish I could do the French accent, which could do this justice, but I can't, so I won't. Colette cannot exist without Colette. Fernando, is that a bit too melodramatic to be the real reason?
No, of course not. I think there should be more drama because, and I think it's a beautiful, beautiful way that they're closing the shop. I mean, I'm very sad because, you know, I've been there many times. I think it's a very relevant shop for the Parisian, you know, shopping scene when it opened 20 years ago, and I think honestly the owner, she just wants to retire, and she knows that if she sells the name to someone else it wouldn't be the same Colette. So I actually think the statement is correct.
What is the Colette shopping experience like? If people were able to tune in for the visual version of this show, they would probably identify me quite quickly as somebody who wasn't a regular customer, but all I really know about it is that it was very flash and you can buy 73 different varieties of mineral water.
Well, and also they like to promote like young designers, so when you go there you know that you see something trendy, something new, something exciting. You know, I've been there I believe like around four times. Every time I go to Paris actually was a place that I had to go, and it's fascinating. There are things there that I couldn't buy anywhere else, and I'm a bit sad, and I don't know about you guys, that the shop closed.
Yeah, it is kind of sad, but I agree with you that it's sort of I don't think it's melodramatic at all that she's closing because Colette cannot exist without Colette. I think in an age where, you know, fashion is being bought by big groups and sort of some can say losing a bit of its identity or integrity, I think it's kind of nice that, you know, a family-run business decides to close its store instead of sell out. So no, not too melodramatic.
I also have to point out that Colette apparently lives above Colette. Mm.
Yes, she does. She does, famously.
So why would she want to live above, you know, somebody else owning her baby?
You make a fair point.
They're keeping the space, though. I think they're renting, perhaps to Saint Laurent. I mean, I don't think it's confirmed, but they're keeping the space for sure.
Saint Laurent, I believe, is the rumor. Yes, we should move finally along tonight to a potentially tricky topic. Let's see if we can get through the next 3.5 minutes without hurling any furniture at each other. We do need to look at a new study by Boffins from Stanford University, into which nationalities are the biggest walkers in terms of average steps per day, and from which they therefore seek to extrapolate which are the laziest and which are the least lazy countries. Now, we have three nationalities represented in this room, among the four of us. Fernando, have you got the list there?
Oh, yeah, I've got my own list, because apparently...
You've got your own list.
Have you rearranged it?
You've just come in with a list which has just got Brazil best at everything at
yes.
the top. Well, that sounds...
Because you just want to count the steps, but I want to see the whole full picture.
This is what they've done. They have actually counted the average steps that nationalities take. The global average is 4,961 per day. Brazil's a bit below that average. Australia is comfortably above. US, a meager, Danny, 4,774.
Because it's so big, we drive everywhere.
And I hope you're thoroughly ashamed of yourself. But China, which is also a big country, actually came top, 6,189 steps per day.
Because people don't drive in the countryside.
Careful now.
What? No, it's true. It's literally all about...
you were about to leap aboard some stereotype about bicycles, weren't you?
No, of course. No, it's not a stereotype. But, I mean, Americans literally drive everywhere. I mean, I used to live in the suburbs. Nobody would even think about walking anywhere.
That is lazy.
You'd hop in... Well,
that you're confirming.
Danny, I've been to the American suburbs. People are reluctant to walk from their front doors to the car.
Yeah, but is that lazy? Can't you build the modern world on a sofa?
I would say yes,
yeah, fair
frankly.
Enough.
The Washington Post did extrapolate from this headline, Americans are much lazier than the Chinese.
Well, I mean, right now, I'd probably agree with that.
Well, it's both probably true and yet somewhat ridiculous an extrapolation to make. Fernando, what is the survey you have over there?
Well, because, you know, of course, you're just talking about steps. Cool, Brazilians, they don't walk that much, but when you... look at the whole activity inequality. There's a list which counts also the steps, but we look at other factors like obesity, how many times you do exercise.
Okay.
Australia does quite bad, Andrew.
Imagine my surprise.
It's at the bottom together with Saudi Arabia.
Oh, come off it.
No, it's true. I mean, and I must say, Brazil's not that good as well. We're only number 22.
Two peas in a pod, Saudi Arabia and Australia.
The US can say... not a lot, because you're number 42 as well, Danny.
Who ranks top in that list you have?
It's Hong Kong. So Hong Kong and China. So
okay.
Clearly they are actually not lazy at all.
Who ranks second? I'm trying to find some.
So we have Sweden, South Korea, Czech Republic, Japan, Singapore.
Are you at least able to confirm that New Zealand doesn't figure ahead of Australia? Because that would obviously be unbearable.
No. New Zealand doesn't.
That's when we bring in the fifth nationality of this program, who's currently like jeering from the production
waiting booth. Behind door number three.
No, has New Zealand finished above Australia in there?
They are above Australia, but you're both quite bad.
Can we really infer anything about these sort of different nationalities from surveys like this, Gaia?
Well, I think there's a case to be made about laziness. I think, you know, Andrew, you were saying before that we're all lazy and lying down in hammocks. But I think
I never said any such thing.
Yeah, you did. That on Brazil, we're lazy, laying down in hammocks, drinking caipirinhas.
I'm pretty sure.
Those are fighting words.
For all our Brazilian listeners, that was Danny who said that.
AM at Monocle.
What I'm saying is...
DG at Monocle.com.
What I was going to say is there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I would much rather be in a hammock drinking a caipirinha right now than walking up and down the flight of stairs.
It's the middle class dream.
I wonder if you're on a treadmill, does it count as a step?
Yeah. Are you making a sort of metaphorical, allegorical inquiry there, or is that a literal question?
Let's ask the Stanford University guys.
On that wistful note, that is the end of today's show. Gaia Lutz, Daniel Giacopelli, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. We'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 22:00. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.